This podcast is intended for mature audiences and could be triggering to some. Please use discretion when listening.
All right, let's do this! Welcome, everyone, to our very first Something Was Wrong Live here in Sacramento. So please give it up for Sarah Lewis and Tiffany Reese.
I can't see anybody. You all look great.
How are you guys feeling? Are you nervous?
I'm hella nervous.
A little bit.
Hella nervous?
Hella nervous.
Yo, we're
That's
doing
the
it.
NorCal nervous.
Like, I see the jumpsuit. I don't know.
So let's just kick it off. How did the podcast come to be? Let's talk about that a little bit.
So the podcast came to be through you. I think actually one of our mutual friends had sort of like hinted to me. Alyssa has a story that she needs to tell you when she gets here tonight, because I heard like 3 seconds of it and I'm pretty sure it's a good story. And like, you're a notorious good storyteller. I was already pumped about it, and you're like, well, my friend was supposed to be getting married. I don't know the story, but like, I know that like XYZ happened.
Yes. This was at a divey bar in East Sacramento, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was for our friend's birthday party. And I had smoked probably like 2 joints at this point.
Yeah.
And because like I have 3 kids, so and we're in California, so suck it. And you were telling me the story, and I was just like, oh my god. And you didn't know all the details, but I was just like, what is happening? And I remember the one thing that I remember for sure was the cellulite text.
Everybody. Oh God, yes.
This Everybody remembers.
You were like, all I know is this fucking guy created this fake person and somehow brought up her cellulite, and that's all I needed to hear. I was like, podcast right now, fucking get it together. Okay, ladies, let's get in formation, because I was like, no. And honestly, I was like, I need to know this story. I'm a really curious person. And I was just looked at you and I was like, that would be such a good podcast. And you were like, yeah. And I was like, yeah. And I remember like standing in a group of people and like they were like, oh god, they're talking about podcasts again, like, you know, just like walking away. And you and I throughout the night would just stare at each other and randomly just be like,
and you and Michael, shout out to Michael who checked you all in, Michael Reese, had a podcast for like a hot minute. Did you do like 3 episodes?
Yeah, we did 3 episodes, and then football season started, so I should have known that I was gonna not be able to commit from there. I should have known myself better. But it turns out you can edit podcasts while watching football, I learned this past year. So it ended up working out okay this time.
Yeah. So Sarah, what were your initial thoughts when you were approached about this?
So you texted me, and I remember the wording was so thoughtful and so diplomatic, as you always are. But I knew the source too. So my first thought was, ooh, like a podcast. And I thought, oh, wait. It's about my worst nightmare. And I kind of like paused for a second and thought about it. But knowing you, that was what I think caused me to react positively, because I knew how delicately you approached it and that you valued me as a friend and you wouldn't suggest something that was, you know.
And it was really soon after.
Yeah,
it was within like 2 or 3 months. It was the same summer.
Yeah, I think you texted me in like June, so the wedding was called off in May. I think it was either June or July.
Mm-hmm. Communed at Reese's home.
Yes. So we set it up, and then you came over. We met. We turned on a shittier microphone than that in my kitchen, and that was pretty much the majority of the audio from the first season. And then obviously, as like more things came out over as episodes started releasing, there was more content to record. So, but the majority of it is from that.
And that was about a 5-hour sitting with you.
Six?
Yeah. I know that I bought a lot of snacks from Trader Joe's and no one ate the snacks.
I had some snacks at the beginning.
Because we were all just like, and I don't know why I bought so many crunchy things
and
next to a microphone.
I do remember.
I learned.
Yeah.
The first couple hours, we were being really polite and like being very aware of our reactions and stuff. And by the end, I swear to God, I was like up pacing the room.
You were literally
pacing.
I heard
all the details. I was like, are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah.
I didn't even think about what it would be like for you as a longtime friend, because we've known each other for what, over 10 years-ish around there. To hear the story, I like switch into storytelling mode and I'm not thinking about it. And by the end, we're flipping tables and throwing snacks and screaming yelling.
Yeah. So what's been the hardest part and the most rewarding parts of this experience for both of you guys?
I'll let you go first.
Okay. I'll start with the hardest. I think the hardest part was also the most surprising. I'm pretty fortunate to have a lot of people around me that are very validating. Nobody was dismissive, everybody, and I realize that's a gift. I think the most unexpected part was the internet, to be honest, which I guess isn't that big of a shock to the rest of the world, but the internet sucks. So it was really, my personality type, I want everyone to understand. And so what I wanted the world to understand was that he didn't, you know, show up in a red suit with a pitchfork at my front door. He was, you know, an excellent boyfriend. He wasn't a crappy boyfriend by any means. So I think my frustration at feeling misunderstood or thinking, am I that, you know, do I just have a penchant for the dramatic? Is that why I told this story? You know, that kind of
thing.
They
knew by episode 3, Sarah. Sorry.
Right, exactly.
I was so like, funny if you were like, I knew by episode 3. I'm like, because you're listening to a like TV show.
Well,
basically.
It is called something. Everything was fine, yeah. You know, right?
Yeah, everything was fine. Everything was fine. We were kicking it.
But yeah, I didn't realize how many sleuths are out there. I mean, if only I'd asked the internet. Nobody was there to see the nuances and the connection and the, you know, I mean, we could read each other from across the room. It wasn't like, you know, I mean, I think it was really hard to portray the level of betrayal, honestly, because the connection is real. You just have to sort through the fact that the person that you connected with doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that's where the breakdown happens, kind of.
Yeah.
That was the hardest part.
What was the best part? Did you already say that?
Hearing Tiffany Reese on the, I can say it exactly how she said it.
Do no, it.
I think the Iris Award moment and the, well, like this, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, the messages and the connections formed, the people that kind of just like literally came out of the woodwork that I had no idea I would have something in common with, and people who had gone through so much more, and how, as weird as the internet was, I also saw the compassion that just spans the globe. There were just so many people that immediately came forward with warmth and understanding and compassion, and it was truly beautiful. But my other favorite was like standing at work at the end of the day, and I couldn't leave yet, and I was watching the Iris Awards streamed online, and coworkers were like videoing me, and when that woman said Tiffany Reese like on the mic, it's just like out of body, everything just froze. So that was by far my favorite.
That was a good moment.
Yeah, it was a little crazy.
What about you, Tim?
So I would say the hardest part is also just people putting you in a box and you can't get out of it because they've already made their mind up about you and you're what you think, and they know 100%. It's like people just don't realize that you're real people on the internet, and that's part of the reason, like, while there's a podcast Instagram, like, I direct people towards my personal Instagram. I want people to see my face. Like, I'm a mom. I'm a human being. If you want to talk shit to me, call me on the phone. Cash me outside. But, like, any idiot can write a comment and send a message on the internet. And I just think, like, the hard part is, like, I have imposter syndrome really bad. And I also am a huge people pleaser. And I'm hella codependent, which is, like, probably, you know, how I'm able to also, like, empathize with a lot of people who have been in similar situations. But yeah, it's really hard when you feel like, but I want everyone to like me. Like, I want everyone to like me and think that everything that I'm doing is correct. So that's really hard with the internet.
Can you say a little bit more about that, like the box that you felt like people were putting you into? Was that like a new experience that kind of like, was that a brand new experience for you with the podcast, or was it like a new box that you were never put into? And what kind of, what did that box look like?
Well, it was like twofold, because it was one part feeling really protective of Sarah and
people judging her because she really went, like, put herself out there and trusted me with her story. And I felt very protective of her and her family. And I know them in real life, so I know what amazing people they are. So to hear people just, like, talking badly about them was really hard. Which is why I don't read the iTunes reviews anymore, because I just choose not to, you know, like, you don't get to come into my living room and take a shit. Like, you just don't. I'm not going to do that to you, and you don't get to do that to me, especially if you don't know me. So, like, unless you have a successful podcast, I'm really not interested in your feedback,
it's
to be honest.
It's like Brown says, the only people that can critique you are the people that are in the arena with you.
But it takes, you have to, like, build up a scab, though, to that.
Right.
Like, I had no idea that, like, how people would get. And also, we were dealing with this person in the season, and the season is developing, and, like, he's threatening us, and there's all this other shit going on behind the scenes, and, like, I felt scared at times. I don't know if you ever felt scared. You were like, please show up at my door. I think you were like, I would love nothing more, bitch.
There were moments. No, it wasn't all like
not
that.
Not all like that. But there were some times, yeah. Maybe. Depends on the, like, stage we were at. But, and I definitely felt like that too at times, especially when I felt like he was trying to, like, locate where we lived and doing different things. And so I was just, you know, that was a low point, like, personally. But the high points, there were so many more high points. Just, like, people trusting Sarah and I with, like, their stories, and, like, how many people have come forward, and, like, every day people message us and are sharing their stories, and they're like, we've had people leave abusive relationships after listening to the podcast. We've had people that had just stepped out of situations so similar to Sarah message us and be like, I felt like I was listening to my own story, and, like, I feel so comforted by this. And that was by far the coolest thing to me. Feels like you have purpose.
Yeah. Sarah, if we could go back just for a second, can you touch on a little bit what kind of, like, role the podcast played, if any, in your kind of grieving or mourning or sort of, like, wrapping your head around what happened process?
Oh my gosh. It's hard to explain, like, I don't know where to start, but there's a lot of am I crazy, you know, when you're unraveling everything. So the massive amount of validation and confirmation and education and research that this chick was doing, I didn't know to do all that. I mean, the research I did, I remember when my family and I, when they took me to Cabo instead of my honeymoon, and I came across some article, or maybe my mom sent it to me or something, and I saw the term love bombing and started reading and just read and read and started flipping out because I still hadn't figured out what happened. So that was my first, like, oh, there's a label to this? Are you kidding me? So I think doing the podcast at times was like, oh crap, what have I done? You know, when people's opinions start flooding in, and then you realize, oh, my diary is on the internet. This might get weird. But then people's confirmation and validation was mind-blowing. It was everything.
Yeah, that's awesome. Tiff, so what is the future of the podcast in your mind?
Obviously, like, season two has started, and I've already recorded the interviews for season three. So I have two seasons coming out, hopefully by the end of this year. And then
guys, get ready to binge.
So there'll be a little bit shorter seasons than the first season, obviously, because these stories are different in that they have taken place. There is distance between the story and present time, which I think can be, there's, like, you know, good and bad about things progressing in real time versus not. But just people submit their stories on the website all the time, and it's really, really heavy stuff, and it's everywhere in the world, and stories come in from all sorts of countries, you know, of all nationalities, all gender, all everything. It's the impact is just crazy.
Yeah. What are some of the topics that you're thinking of touching on?
Really, honestly, like, all forms of emotional abuse really interest me. You know, I love, like, cults. I love anything with behavioral science. Like, I love just, like, knowing what makes people be, what motivates people to do the things that they do.
Not because I want to judge them, but I just want to know. Yeah. And I think it's really therapeutic for myself in a selfish way, because I learn about my own experiences through these people. And it's really validating for me as well. And it helps me to see like the diseases that people have and the mental health issues that those individuals have. And I think I've been able to become more sympathetic after Dick towards those people. I think like it's also different when you're like interacting and dealing with that person annoying you versus like other stories where I will, you know, never be in contact likely with that person. So, but yeah.
And I think at least for me, it's been an eye-opening experience through this to see that it seems like there's such a gap in talking about emotional abuse. Like people don't, it's not really something that you talk about. In my own experience with different forms of emotional abuse, I'm like, I try to find other stories and they're just not there. And so I applaud you for giving these men and women a voice and a place to speak to you and speak to each other. And I think it's really important work. So, Sarah, before we get to our next little section, do you have any new Dick
developments
that you can share since you were on season one of the podcast?
I feel like so much goes by, like so many random things. Just like you can't even keep up.
I'm trying to think of when the last episode came out. I mean, other than not like in
the ex-girlfriend or the girl from. Has anything happened since then?
No, I mean I met his first fiance in person. That's a I forgot about that when I was in Nashville. That was fun. It's creepy how alike we are, but then again, makes sense. He is currently engaged. Rumor has it.
He's engaged.
Yeah.
According to the internet.
Round three. So
round three. That's a real dick. So season two has begun. And our lovely star of season two is actually here tonight. So I would like to welcome to the stage T. So T and Sarah have actually T and Sarah have actually never met. So T, this is Sarah. They have the same sparkly Converse. Thank you, universe.
These are my, like, favorite shoes.
She's the best.
So, T, this is Sarah. Sarah, this is T. Oh,
super casual. Super casual meeting. Here, you sit there.
So, T, have a seat. So, hi, T. Welcome.
Did you guys listen?
Yeah. Did you guys listen to
episode 2? Shut up.
Yeah. Of course, these are the diehards. They're here.
I know, but I didn't think anyone. I told her, I don't even think 100 people are going to hear my story.
She was really concerned. Girl. She was like, do you think like 1,000 people? And I was like,
I'll try 1,000 countries.
Yeah. Are there that many?
She's like screenshotting me the Apple tunes, and I'm like, I still don't believe you. No one's heard it.
So, T, what's it like to meet Sarah? Because you listened to season one, correct?
Yeah, so weird. So, I'm not a podcast girl, and I work at a veterinary hospital. One of my sales reps came in, and she's like, I'm binging this podcast. You have to hear it. And I was like, okay. So, I listened to it, and this one, she is like a therapist on the air. Like, it's amazing. And I'd been waiting 10 years to tell my story.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, this is the person I want to tell my story. And I didn't think she would ever respond to me and that she would ever like message me back. I messaged her on Facebook. I'm like, 100,000 people listen to your thing. You're never going to answer me back.
I think I messaged you back like right away.
Yeah.
I was like, what up? I'm doing nothing.
And I'm like, my thing was, I don't think you're going to believe me. And she's like, I don't really need to doubt you. And I'm like, because truth is very much stranger than fiction. And then she's like, dude, I have a lot going on. Like, I just won the Iris Award. I'm like, I know. And so it's like, and she's like, I promise I'll be in touch. I was like,
I was dead inside at that point. I was so tired from season one. I was. I was really so dead inside.
Yeah.
It was just emotional.
A bit much.
Yeah. I did not believe that she would ever one, respond to me, two, that she would ever respond again. And then I was like, the drug rep that had introduced me, I was like, Tiffany Reese just texted me, oh my God. And then, like, no one realizes what a big deal this is to me. Like, 10 years I've been waiting to tell my story. Like, this was my life. Like, people are now messaging me and they're like, oh, I can't wait. And I'm like, yeah, this was my life though, dude. This was not, this happened to me. It was horrific.
That was something that we talked about a lot through season one as it was rolling out and getting the response and stuff was so overwhelming. And a lot of it was really difficult. We started referring to it as people wanting their trauma porn. And just like, oh God, what happened? And being unsatisfied with the ending because no one died, and kind of everyone kind of becoming a character. And it can be difficult because, you know, there's such a, it's a line between sharing your story and getting that community and people really feeling seen and understood. And also,
well, how can you understand this? This is not understandable. Like, what happened to me and my family and my bestie there, it's not understandable. Like, it's not, like, people don't do this. Like, I mean, I was so, it was just poetic justice at the timing that the act came out with Gypsy Rose. I mean, you hear about that, but it's on, like, Nightline. It's not for real. This really happened to me. It happened to my family. And it was 4 years of my life. Like, this lady kept this story going for 4 years.
Wait, episode 3 is like 2 years in.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
I'm talking to you, girl, and I'm not giving it away.
No, I know. I don't know.
You got to listen.
Girl.
Yeah.
No. Right, so you guys, seriously.
No. But it was 4 years.
Well, welcome to the Something Was Wrong family.
There's something wrong, let me tell you.
So let's move on to the question and answer time for a little while. So if you have a question, raise your hand. Also, unfortunately, we're not going to direct any questions to T. We can't do any spoilers. Sorry. I suppose if you do have a question that pertains to the first three episodes, totally fine.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, who's the brave one to start us out? Yes, over here.
You had kind of mentioned to me about how it's kind of therapeutic for you to help other people in the sense and to hear these stories. So it sounds like maybe there's stuff that you've been through as well. Do you think you might ever tell your story?
Tiffany, do you think you might ever share more of your own personal story?
You know, I think I'd be a huge hypocrite if I didn't. I think I'm getting there. I think, like, being around these ladies and getting the messages from other people, like, makes me want to be vulnerable. But I gotta tell you, like, I shared such a small amount on the first season about, like, with my relationship with my father, and I got messages from people on Instagram, and they're like, you need to just do this with your life, you need to do this with your relationship. And it was, I was just like, I can't, I mentally just, I don't know. So I definitely want to, but I prefer to talk about other people, so we'll see. But yeah, I don't know what that will look like or whatever, but I definitely want to, and I think, like, it's important if I expect other people to be vulnerable myself. Otherwise, like, it's pretty hypocritical, so.
All right, who's next? Yes, we're going to talk.
I'm curious how you settled on the title, Something Was Wrong, because it does contain spoilers.
Everything was fine? Is that what you said?
Why the title Something Was Wrong?
I just, what stood out to me talking to just in all the interviews was, like, that was the common thread, was just like there was just something there that was, like, unspeakable. And I think I really believe it's like that fear that protects us, and sometimes we listen to it and sometimes we don't because we're humans. And I think, like, the core of emotional abuse is really hard to pin down, and you don't really know what exactly it is because it's so, like, insidious and so just snaky. I don't know what the right word is. Is that a word? Probably not. But yeah, I just kept, I just knew it was, something was wrong. I remember specifically Rose. Is Rose here?
There's Rose.
Yes.
She's in the back.
Hey. I just remember her saying that, and she was like up at night, you know, and like my kids are still small, but I think as a mom myself, like listening to her, I always like already I'm trying to get the like word into my kids. I'm like, you need to be 35 before I even meet somebody that you're dating. Don't even come at me. No, I want them to be happy. But it's just like as a mother, it's so hard to just like you have these kids and then they just go do whatever the hell they want at some point. You have no control over what they can do anymore. And it's like, you know, one day you're like, hey, I'm in charge of your snacks, and the next day they're dating dick and you can't do shit about it, you know.
It's true.
You just have to sit there and be like, I'm so happy for you, you know. And like, I think everybody's so, yeah, that really resonated with me. I got totally off topic, so
love it.
Cool.
And the music, can I just say the music?
Spot the music, that song.
So
right?
Good.
Dude, the crazy thing about that, if we have time, I hopefully, yeah, I think
we got time.
So I just went to, you know, like everything on the podcast that I just learned from the internet. You know, the internet sucks, but it taught me everything I know. So I was just on this random website. It's like freepodcastmusic.com or some like God knows. It's like the third page of Google search, because I was just like, I have no money for this. I had, you know. And I was just going through pages, and it said, you think, I listened to it, and I remember I recorded it right away with my phone, and I sent it to both of you, and we were just like, boom, like, done, like, that song was written for this, done.
It was too
perfect. It was.
Yes, right here.
My question is specifically for Sarah, but if you guys all have something to say, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are. I'm curious what it's been like to learn how to listen to your gut instincts again after your gut led you astray potentially, and if that's like still a process that you're undergoing.
What's it like to listen to your gut and or not listen to your gut? How do you relearn how to listen to your gut? Yeah.
That's a really good question. That's been very eye-opening, and it's helped me to see other relationships and scenarios and people. I work in a place where I see a lot of people all day, and it's almost been like a mental game of practicing what I recognize and going, oh, I had that same feeling with this other person, and connecting the dots and going, oh, that's what that feeling means. Because before, yes, I mean, there were times where I know we said in the podcast I had no red flags, but now I know I did have red flags, but I just didn't know how to label that feeling. Now I know how to label it. And now I can see it coming from a mile away. If I meet somebody with similar traits, in a heartbeat, I go, oh, okay. But it was definitely like a compare and contrast game for the past year and a half.
Yeah. Do you guys want to touch on that at all?
I think gaslighting is really hard to get over. I think being told...
Can you just talk a little bit about what gaslighting is, just for a second, just like a refresher, what gaslighting is?
I mean, Isaac.
Isaac.
Yeah, you come up here and explain it.
This is Isaac Smith.
He's going to be back, but...
He's going to be back on stage.
You could do a better job. Look at this freaking outfit. Are you kidding me? He, like, called me 3 days ago. He's like, I'm worried about my outfit. I'm like, please.
So basically, gaslighting is when somebody tries to convince you that your perception of something is wrong, and you really start to doubt your own, you know, your gut. Like, am I really crazy? Like, you mentioned that. Like, am I really crazy? Like, this person has been telling me. Am I not seeing this the right way? So it's just a game in order to get you to doubt what you really feel is your truth. So it's a lot of minimization and trying to sweep things under the carpet as quickly as possible to get you to doubt your own self.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Isaac,
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Good job. Tiff,
just listening to your gut, I mean, is that how do you remind yourself like how to do that?
I think it's like something that I have definitely had to learn since the jump of the podcast, and just like where I was at in sort of like my social emotional state that I was going through before the podcast even began, was just like, you cannot let other people tell you who you are, like especially people who are going to that are committed to not knowing who the fuck you actually are. Like, who cares what those people think? And it's taken me a really long time to get there, and it's something I struggle with all the time. But I just, growing up with addicts and alcoholics in my family, and you develop a codependency with other people, and something I have learned is like, oh, maybe I'm recreating that shit with other people now. And for me, it was like a lot of like female relationships in my life, which I think you know, I really relate to that about season two. Female relationships have been really hard for me. So kind of like learning how to like have certain types of relationships for me, but have boundaries and like respect what other people think of me without letting it be the definition of who I am. And that's where gaslighting can be really poisonous, when you let other people not only like tell you who you are, but what reality is, you know.
Yeah.
It can really be hazardous.
Yeah. T, do you have anything?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you listen to season two at all, like, I realized like the last episode, I was like, that was odd. That was odd. I said like, that was odd, like 55 times. But that was odd in retrospect, but when you were going through it, it wasn't odd because they're telling you it's not odd. This is the way it is. And when you're immersed with someone who is manipulating you and lying to you and twisting your head, and people will convince you that like what's happening, oh no, this is normal. This is, you know, but trying to let someone in after that, no. My friend circle, it's closed. No, it means.
No new friends.
No. Yeah, no, I can't. Yeah. No.
Mm-mm. Yeah. And I think just.
What about me?
You're in.
All right.
Oh, good. Tiffany's in. Good choice. Good.
Yeah. And I'm fine with the circle.
Yeah. The circle of trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just very touching tight. Back on kind of what Sarah was saying, for me, it's been. An eye-opening experience through season one, just to get really close to the two of you in a new way, and we're going to talk a little bit about platonic friendships in the next part of the show. But I had an experience when we were in the middle of season one with a friend, and I didn't know what was happening. It was like Isaac said, I literally felt crazy. I thought, is my instinct this shitty? Like, am I just completely misreading everything about this? And I felt, I literally felt like a cloud was going over my brain. I had like a constant headache. And I was just like, maybe I'm completely wrong about this. And Sarah and Tiff.
Good thing you had us. We're like 2 minutes in. We're like, break this down.
They said.
Okay.
I'm like, run.
We've got ourselves a narcissist minimum.
To see that you're being gaslit when you're being gaslit, like that's kind of the whole point.
Yeah.
And so when they said it, I was like, oh, I get this now. This is what this feels like. And that was major for me. And I think just like trusting your gut, I look back on that friendship and there were parts of it that were incredible, of course. Like, you know, they're not standing at the door with a friggin' pitchfork, come on in, like it's not how it is. And for me, looking back and knowing that there were always those moments where I'm like, that's not right, that's not okay, but I excused it. I made, you know, I had reasons for saying like, that was fine, whatever, that's just who she is, for years. And then I got out of it and I was like, I can't do that to myself again, you know? I think that we have time for two more questions, yeah, right here.
So Dick's real identity was revealed in some places on the internet. I'm wondering if there were any repercussions, or if you heard from him about that.
Yeah. Were there any repercussions of Dick's real identity being revealed online?
Other than him asking for our mailing addresses for legal purposes, that I don't think that he.
And then he created a fake, of several fake accounts, like Instagram. Tried to communicate with the. He was.
He's still doing that, right?
He created fake accounts to join the Facebook group. Created fake accounts to then start talking to women who are sharing their vulnerabilities in the Facebook group.
Oh, yeah.
And trying to steer people falsely in the Facebook group. And I'm like flying to the Iris Awards at this time. And I remember he had made up this fake girl and her name was so-and-so at...
It was Sarah. It was spelled with an H.
Sarah, spelled with an H. Yeah. Like, bitch.
Very
and then... he worked at Temple.
Yeah, he picked these local Sacramento spots, but the cover photo was the Dallas skyline, which he loves Dallas. It was just kind of this
weird. And there was three photos, and they weren't the same girl. Well, and so then we were like, I remember sitting in the airport, and we were like trying to figure out how we could determine if this was him, because I was just like, you know, I'm not in the Facebook group, but it was like there was enough communication. He was communicating with somebody who like basically reached out to the admin of the group, Jen, who's awesome. And so we were investigating it. So I was just like, I can't handle this anymore. So I picked up my phone. I'm like in the airport and I'm just like, yeah, Temple Coffee Roasters. Yeah. Does Sarah work there? You don't have any Sarah at this location? Okay. Next location. Hi, Sarah there. Is she working today? Oh, so then I got the HR guy who was happened to be at Temple at the second location I called. Shout out to Temple. Their coffee's great. and he's like, I'm actually making the schedule right now, so I have the employee roster. Sorry to guy on blast.
I not know
I don't know your name, so I'll keep that a secret. But I was like, hey, so yeah, when's Sarah working? And he's like, we don't even have a Sarah here. I'm looking at our employee roster for all three stores. We do not have a Sarah. And I was just like, weird, she must have got a job at Starbucks. Okay, bye.
Were you ever scared?
Yeah. Yeah, there were times. There were nights I had a tough time going to sleep, but I was also at my parents' house, and I have a lot of prickly plants outside my bedroom window. We've had this conversation, but anyway, no, there were nights that it was tough, but I relied on my family and my faith, and also it really, I was relying on experiences of when I did corner him, when I did kind of point a finger at him, every reaction every time was just kind of to go deadpan and to back away. I hadn't had any proof that he would be like go on the aggressive offense. Yeah, yeah, get aggressive.
All right, we've got time for one more quick question. Yes, Beth.
I was just wondering how you got nominated for the IRIS Award and that whole process.
Yeah, the process of the Iris Award.
How are you? I love that I can see your hair outline right now. Like, that's how I know it's you. So I have gone to the Iris Awards for many years, actually since the first year it started, and I have watched many of my friends receive their trophies, and I never thought I would be nominated for one, but I was like, you know what, if I was going to try and get people to vote for me, this felt like the year, because I knew I had worked my ass off, so, and Sarah was excited about it, so we were like, we'll just put it out there and see what happens, but we all were just like, if we get nominated, that'd be super cool. Like, never expected to win. Still don't know how that happened, but really excited about it.
You're amazing.
Look at these people that are here for you.
I remember the whole conference being like, people would be like, are you excited? And I would just be like, I'm really nervous because I know I'm going to make a face when they call Ashton Kutcher's name or whatever his name is. What was it? Dash Decker. Yeah, the other guy. So I was like, I just was like really concerned and talking to everyone about like, does this face look convincing that I'm happy for this person? It's like not, because I was just so fixated on that. Like, that was all I could think about was, like, I didn't want people to not think that I was happy for the actual person that was going to win, because there was no way that was going to be me.
I remember that was your main concern in our text thread.
Yes.
Like, my face, you guys. You're like, you'll be fine.
You'll be, yeah. You're like, no one's going to be looking at the losers. No one's just going to. Nobody said that. But yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. Amazing. All right, well, if you guys would give these lovely ladies a hand.
We good.
Here we go. We're recording. Great. Welcome back. Going to change things up a little bit and speak to a couple of experts on all these topics. So if you guys wouldn't mind introducing yourselves, please.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chevis Mays, and I am a domestic violence expert. And I call myself an expert because I do have lived experience. As a survivor, and now I work in the field, and I have been working in the field for 22 years as one of the board of directors for the State Coalition, which is the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence.
Great, thank you so much. You're welcome.
My name is Isaac, and I'm primarily a therapist in private practice. I've got a cozy little spot here in Midtown, and then also in Fair Oaks, and I also do some work at a local homeless shelter in Roseville and in Auburn. So.
Thank you. Welcome, Isaac. Thank you. All right. So, Isaac, I have some questions for you first. So on the bonus episode, you talked to Tiffany a lot about leaving domestic abusers. And can you talk a little bit about any tips that you have for leaving a relationship that's not romantic, such as a friendship that you realize is toxic? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I'd say like a lot of the same things apply. If you notice that you're in a toxic relationship or friendship, the first thing that I would probably tell someone to do is to focus on that reconnecting with themselves. A lot of the times, like if you think about an abusive relationship, somebody's been telling you what to think and what to feel and how to act for so long. And you need some space to get reconnected with your gut to learn to be able to trust that again. And I think that first being able to take that space to do some grieving around that. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people that I work with, their main coping strategy is just to go to distraction. Mm-hmm. And that's a useful strategy, but when it becomes something that you apply to everything, you miss out on that space of connecting with the pain. And pain can really teach you a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So reconnect with yourself and also start to build or reconnect with some of those relationships that with people that have been there for you the entire time, right? People that don't just love you when you're doing your best, but have been with you when you've been at your lowest. And when you're in abusive relationships, abusive people try to pull you away from those healthy relationships because it makes their job easier. So reconnecting in that way, I think, is the first step, and then just taking some space to do some of the grieving that needs to happen.
Yeah. So if someone comes to you and says, I don't even know how to reconnect with myself anymore, I'm that lost, what are some good starting points for them?
Yeah, I mean, this is not a fun one, so this is not a Disneyland answer, but it's learning to actually be with that pain. And that's really scary sometimes. And you have to do that at your own pace and kind of let that out in doses that you can handle. But learning to sit and locate, I believe a lot of the work that I do with people is about with mindfulness and getting them to tune back in with their body. So figuring out where some of those feelings hang out in the body and being with them, again, in doses that you can handle, and then go to your distraction. I think writing, like downloading your brain, can be a really useful tool to help you get reconnected to that inner voice. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you've been in an abusive relationship long enough, you might subconsciously not even know that you're looking for somebody to be like your life coach. Right? Like even people that have really good intentions, like family members that are close, you might look for people to kind of lead that way, and you'll have to resist some of those urges, right? Be mindful to some of those urges to look for somebody else first, right? Mm-hmm. Who's on your board of directors inside of your heart? Mm-hmm. And putting...
I read that. That was deep. Wow. So wait, say that one more time.
Just like people put folks on their board of directors to be like, this is how I'm supposed to live my life. Mm-hmm. Like, without trusting their own voice, so.
That was good. I like that.
Sorry, my brain is like, okay. That's great, Isaac. Thank you. So any tips for toxic people that you can't avoid? A boss, a coworker, a relative. What are some strategies that you have?
Okay. So first of all, I would probably ask someone a difficult question of like, do you really have to be around this person? And is this job really worth it enough to continue to be abused on a daily basis? You know, if it's like, if it's a situation where you're like, you're feeding your family, right? That's, you're going to have to manage that while trying to look for something else. But I don't think that anybody should sign up to endure that. And the same right, and this is not a popular answer as well, so I'm sorry. But what is the rule that you have to like your family? You know, some family members are toxic people that haven't earned the right for you to be around and to speak truth into your life at all. Again, like in my life, I try to look for people who have been there for me at all stages and really pay attention to what they say. Say like, hey, Isaac, you're being a knucklehead here. Like, you need to get this shit squared away, right? I'm going to listen to them much more than I'm going to listen to people that don't know me as well. I might still like take what they say and evaluate and say like, is there any truth to that? But it's not going to hold as much weight because there's an extra vulnerability over here with the people that have been there for me. So.
You talked a little bit about the self-care. I know that's kind of like a buzzword right now, but can you talk about the importance of that as well as talking a little bit about how codependency can kind of deplete us?
Yeah. So if you kind of notice that you have some of those codependent tendencies, okay?
Which one would possibly look like?
Mainly it's like, if that person's in a happy mood, you're in a happy mood. If they're in a shit mood, you're in a shit mood. You know, it's really like your moods are all dependent on that other person, or all of your energy goes to trying to take care of someone else, right? Mm-hmm. Like lots of people are caregivers, you know, nurses, therapists, anybody in a helping profession can have caregiving tendencies. So that can burn you out like nothing else. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're there too, that's when you've lost a lot of your own voice as well, when you're just focusing on taking care of somebody else. So, mm-hmm. you know, figuring out ways that really bring you life, things that you like to do, those can all be self-care activities. You know, talking to a therapist can be a self-care activity.
This is a tough one for me. The line between vilifying someone in your life or someone that was in your life that has narcissistic or toxic tendencies, mm-hmm. vilifying them, and where's the line between that and excusing their behavior because it's just who they are and the tools that they have because of trauma or poor parenting?
That's a really great question. So... let me see.
You better
start.
Have a good answer. Yeah. Solve the world's problems.
I think a lot of times, yeah. Okay, so I'm sure lots of you guys have heard this really cliche therapist thing to say, which is that hurt people, right? I'm sure everybody's heard that, okay? So unfortunately, sometimes people use their painful past or whatever as a license to treat people however they want, or as an excuse. So I think that there's understanding, like you can understand why somebody might have behaved or treated you in a certain way, but that doesn't mean that behavior is okay. Also, like if you've been in abusive relationships for a long time, another reason why it's important to reconnect with yourself is because the fastest way to find out what your triggers are or what lights up is to get into a relationship, whether that's romantic or another friendship. So sometimes your own past and your own traumas can color your lenses a little bit, and you might think that something is going on that's not actually going on, right? And the way to work that out is in a context of a healthy relationship where you can talk about like, okay, I was triggered by this thing that it felt exactly how I felt before when I was in this kind of bad relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's good to take some of that space. You know, I work with a lot of people that are struggling with addiction, whatever your party is. And in AA, they have this kind of rule where they say, it's not a rule, but they say, hey, maybe you should take about a year off of romantic relationships while you're getting sober to give yourself some space. And I think that same type of thinking is really helpful if you've been into a toxic romantic relationship. Like, you should not be running off and getting into a relationship quickly. You need to pull back, take space, tune in, listen to yourself, and then maybe explore those things.
Thank you.
It's powerful.
Yeah. What kind of help is out there for people with personality or behavioral disorders?
Yeah, so therapy again. I would say with personality disorders in particular, like you need some pretty intensive therapy. sometimes it can be, there can be a tendency to villainize people that have some of those things. But I've worked with a lot of people that have recognized that they have some of that junk and they want to work on it. And they want to get help and they know that they've hurt people. So I think intensive therapy is needed for personality disorders. That's just my thought and belief.
You mentioned that you do some work with the homeless community. And what are some of the impacts of emotional abuse that you see in the homeless community?
I mean, I a lot of the people that I've worked with have dealt with abuse in some point in their life. I think, like, this is the thing about abuse, kind of like addiction, is it doesn't really discriminate at all. Like, it affects people, all walks of life, socioeconomic statuses. You name it. People can, it can look great on the outside and there could be like horrendous things going on behind closed doors. So abuse can impact and affect everybody. And it, you know, I was writing about this for a blog on my site, but you know, this idea of people being strong enough, like if you're strong enough, you won't suffer from abuse. Or if you're strong enough, you would leave that relationship. And I think that's bullshit. Yes. It's not about strong enough.
Right.
As Sarah was like saying, you know, she didn't recognize a lot of these things were hurt because nobody does. You're in the early stages of love. You don't recognize red flags because, you know, I could geek out on the brain and what's going on, but, you know, there's all these hormones. Well, there's all these hormones and chemicals that are firing to, like, bring you together, like oxytocin and dopamine. It's a reward thing. So in the beginning, you just kind of see, like, people kind of get obsessive about that person, and they just ignore a lot of things because it feels so good to be in love. That's why I tell everybody that I work with that are starting a new relationship, everybody puts their best foot forward.
In the beginning.
Nobody shows you their shitty side up front, very rarely, right? They're just kind of like peacocking and, you know, like love bombing, you know, like all these great things. So I think it's good to like enjoy that and take time and watch and get to know somebody.
Shabazz, you were very much in agreement with a lot of what Isaac was saying. Is there anything that you would like to expand on, touch on, that he mentioned?
Yes, the main thing that I would like to touch on is for those of you in the room that are survivors or know someone that is a survivor, the number one thing that you need to know is that the abuse was not and is not your fault. Domestic violence is clearly, it's a power and control tactic that people that harm use in order to gain that power over their victim. Yeah. So to add to what he says, just know that because there are times when, you know, we could be triggered or thoughts could come up in our mind and we feel like, gosh, I should have did this different, I should have did that different. And there's absolutely nothing you could have done differently to stop the person that harmed doing what they did. So it's not your fault.
Wow, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
So can you talk to us a little bit about Stand Up Placer,
yes,
who they are, what's their mission, and what do you do on a day, on a day-to-day basis?
Okay, so Stand Up Placer is a domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking agency that has been in business for 41 years for Placer County. Our mission is saving lives by empowering survivors and educating the community to stand up to domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. Excuse me for getting tongue-tied because I'm excited about about the work I do, and it's just so much that we provide. We have a 24-hour crisis line where you could call in anonymously and talk to a crisis counselor. We have a 24-hour shelter that is all gender inclusive. We're pet friendly. We are in an undisclosed location where survivors can stay up to 90 days.
Wow.
Which in most shelters, you can only stay 30 days. Another service that we provide at the shelter is it's a 55-bed facility. So even with it being a 55-bed facility, it's still not enough space because our crisis line is ringing all the time throughout the day. And there's people that we cannot get into the shelter because we're full. So one of the beautiful things about Stand Up Plaster is when that does happen, we do have some contracts with different hotels in the area to where we could bring those families in until we can get them in our shelter.
That's amazing. Wow. Yes.
And as far as what I do, I am the housing manager. I have a 24-month program to where I bring people in my program, give them life skills, financial coaching, support groups, and I pay their rent up to 2 years while they're rebuilding their lives. Okay. So they can also receive services. One of the programs that I oversee is it's called a one-time assistance program. And this is where if they don't have, they might have housing lined up, but they can't afford to pay the deposits or even get into a program, we can help them with that assistance, as well as keep them for maybe 6 months, maybe keep them for the year, just depending. As long as they're fleeing or have had the experience and they are a Placer County resident, we can assist them. And we do also accept out of county. It just really depends on how many beds we have available. Yeah. And they can live anywhere they want in Placer County. So we don't cherry pick where they live. We let them be the ones to pick where they want to live because it's about them taking control and us being trauma informed.
Yeah. How do you see organizations like Stand Up Placer impacting the community as a whole?
Domestic violence, it affects communities like no other. So if I'm a survivor of domestic violence and I've reached out and the community is helping me, it helps my family, it helps my neighbors, it reduces crime, and it reduces harm. So that's what Stand Up Placer's focus is to help harm reduction. One person coming out of DV can save a whole family and community.
Wow. Yeah.
And is the domestic violence is on the rise, especially in Placer County, especially with human trafficking. We're seeing them very young. We've already had 2 human trafficked seniors. Okay? Mm. We've had to turn away 500 people from our shelter because of no space. Domestic violence and sexual assault, it costs Placer County $500,000 for one incident. So supporting this cause, and not just Stand Up Placer, but any DV agency, your dollars count. Your volunteer services count. Anything that you feel like you can, shop it at our thrift store, facilitating a support group, just whatever it is you feel that you have, it makes a difference in the community and it does reduce harm. And I'm a living witness because when I was in my DV situation, I knew nothing about a domestic violence shelter. I just had to endure. And so it was just by the grace of God that I somehow had a hedge of protection around me to be able to flee that situation and then find out in being in that situation, I learned this was my passion and this was my purpose.
Thank you so much. I feel like we need to get So how can allies get involved or support the work of nonprofits such as Stand Up Placer?
Okay, well, you can start by liking us on Facebook, following us on Instagram, Twitter. You can go to our website, which is standupplaster.org. You can donate your gently used items to our thrift boutique in Roseville on Santa Clara Drive. If you know where the Hobby Lobby's at, we're right in there. And just, you know, have us come give a training at your organization or at your clubs or, you know, things like that.
Yeah. And Tiff, correct me if I'm wrong, do we have a donation?
Yes, there is a donation jar in the front if you are a person who is mature enough to carry cash. Or you can go to the website and donate. It's very easy to access. It will be linked in the show notes. There is, for people who are here, there are pamphlets and things like that.
Yes. So you'll find these out there and some pamphlets.
So more information about donating, volunteering, I assume is on the website.
Yes, it is.
Great. And you guys are at Stand Up Placer.
StandUpPlacer.org. And you're talking about
and then for like Instagram, Twitter.
Yes, Stand Up Placer.
Great. And then Isaac, where can we find you online?
I also have one of those Facebooks. So you can find me at wholewellnesstherapy.com.
Also linked in the show notes.
Linked in the show notes, yes.
I'll try to remember.
Okay.
Great. So, time for questions. I know you guys must have questions. Yes.
I have one. So if there is someone in your life who you think is struggling with mental illness but is resistant to accepting that, and it's really negatively impacting their life, like what are some strategies to try and help them seek help?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. It's a really tough position to be in. I would like frame this kind of like through that lens of dealing with some sort of addiction, right? If you were struggling with an alcohol problem, chances are that friends and family coming to you and saying, hey, you've got a problem, is not going to work. Unfortunately, it might get you to start to think about something like that. But the tone of that is really important, how you approach that. Until that person is really ready to face that stuff in their own life, there's unfortunately little that you can do other than just say, hey, I think something's going on and I see this thing potentially impacting your life and I don't know, you know, because you're dealing with it, but I'm here for you if you need anything, you know, and just kind of show up. Not a lot of people these days show up for people, and sometimes the best thing you can do is just give your presence to somebody else mm-hmm. without trying to dictate anything.
Mm-hmm. Can I kind of piggyback on that a little bit? And I also think that removing the stigma, because there's a lot of stigma surrounded, around mental health and stuff. And so if we could like just reduce that stigma, not reduce it, but just eradicate it, you know, let people know, you know, if you're not feeling well, help is available. And it doesn't mean you're crazy or that doesn't mean any of those negative things.
Another question.
Oh, yes. So I am one of the best crowds ever as well. People when they're in that victim state and that, for example, I have a friend who was horrifically injured and the TA still hasn't contacted her and it's been over a year at this point and they looked at pictures and they said, we'll reach out to you and she's called and she's not coming back. So, and I believe domestic violence isn't actually classified as a violent crime either, which is just outrageous. So what can be done to start seeing change happen so that
one of the things that I would like to say about that is I'm one of them like radical people that's always at the state capitol. Raising hell. I'm one of them people. And so, you know, that's one of the ways that, you know, to get involved is, you know, have these stories for your state legislatures. And when they have public hearings, matter of fact, just last year I was at the state capitol asking for a $50 million increase for housing, for mental health services, not for just victims of domestic violence, but also for the people that harm. Because you can't help people heal if you're just healing like this. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that you can do. Get involved. Get involved with the partnership. That's a great platform. When we have those conferences and when we're asking survivors to be at the table, that's exactly what we need. We need those voices at the table so that we can take that before hearings to make the change. We need you to be a stakeholder in it. Mm-hmm. Well,
preach.
All right, what else? What else do you guys have?
What about Placer County do you think makes domestic violence higher? What do certain counties that have those higher rates have in common?
So what makes Placer County such a higher place for it is because people feel it doesn't happen there. Mm-hmm. Because Placer County, there's money there. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the inner city, it's expected to happen in Sacramento because there's a whole lot of, Sacramento's very diverse. Mm-hmm. Placer County's not. Mm-hmm. So that's why that's one of the number one hubs for it.
Wow.
Yeah, when you live in a nice house, no one checks on you.
Exactly.
Because that was my experience growing up. No one checked on me.
Exactly.
Because my parents had a nice house and a track home in Placer County, and they were Republican voters and, you know, had like, you know, 3.5 dogs or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just no one worries about that person because of the way that we view, because of the stigma that we're putting on this behavior is that it's like, this only happens to others, and this is not, this doesn't happen to my neighbor, and that is, I think, part of the problem. That's how people get away with it.
That's exactly how people get away with it. One of the main people who are trafficked is by the Galleria Mall.
Sunsplash, Galleria Mall. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we're seeing them trafficked as young as 10.
Yeah.
Young as 10 and elderly. So, yes, it definitely happens in all of our backyards. None of us are immune.
Yeah, question right here. So, we're both teachers, actually, in Placer County. And we teach high school. So, we see a lot of signs of kids, teenagers getting involved in abusive relationships. Mm-hmm. But they have no reference point. Or a lot of times they either have never seen it themselves, or in their mind this is just, you know, they've seen it in a TV show and it was romanticized to them. So they think that something like checking on someone's phone all the time is regular. Or, you know, things like that, that once you've experienced a little bit more, you start to understand those signs a little better. But, you know, a 15-year-old doesn't always. So what advice would you give about helping kids sort of start to see those things and understand those things in such a way that going forward they're more aware of how to either avoid those situations or get out of those situations before they become too engulfed in those situations?
So one of the things that I recommend is I also oversee our outreach and prevention program, and we're in the schools. So if you would like us to come and, you know, do a workshop for your school, we're more than happy to do that. And teach, it's called teaching healthy relationships, healthy boundaries, the warning signs, the red flags to pay attention to. So, and we're from middle school all the way up to college. We're now in Sierra College, to where we're taking we have the athletes program to teach them how to be advocates. So we're starting at that level and we're bringing it on down. You got to start young. We have to really get into our institutions and give the education in order to break the cycle.
Yes. Do you have anything to add to that?
I mean, yeah. I've worked with high schoolers for a long time, and I think it's sad that we don't talk about emotional intelligence in our education system. And there's a lot of inherent kind of emotion myths that we face in this country in particular, you know, that there are good and there are bad emotions, and there's a right way and a wrong way to feel, and that showing emotion is weakness, and all this garbage stuff. So being able to like model that when appropriate is really healthy for kids, because they're watching you. And figuring out what those emotion myths that you've bought into in your own life are, and addressing that, I really feel like the more that we get, you know, I've said this already, but the more that, my big belief is, the more that we get connected, right, to ourselves, that improves our relationships with other people. So being able to check in and start to see emotions as what they are, as these things that are there to protect you, to keep you alive, and to listen to them and see what they're trying to say to you.
Was there a question over here?
Yes, actually, I had a teenage daughter, Tiffany knows her, that went through a very similar to Sarah's, and, you know, I wish that she had resources beforehand. What could I do as a parent, because I also have a younger son, in advance to kind of alert them to these patterns? I mean, she was in therapy the second we figured out what was going on. She was in therapy, and honestly, turned her life around. We just sent her to college this week. So
she's doing awesome.
Horrible going through. What could we do early on?
One of the things that I would recommend is always giving them that talk of how much you love them, how worthy they are. And, you know, knowing your worth does miracles. And it's sometimes just that right there, just, you know I love you, know that I'm always going to be here for you. If you ever need to talk, You know, the door is always open. Safety is always first, and not be so quick to judge. I think that's where we mess up as parents. I know when I was in my situation and I told my mother what was happening to me, her response was, well, what did you do?
Yeah.
Chevis, you got a smart mouth. You know, you probably, I'm like, wow, there's nothing that I could ever do to anybody to make them hurt me the way they did. So if her message would have been different, more like, I'm sorry that's happening to you. When you're ready to go, I'm here for you. Whatever you need, there's never, ever going to be a door closed to you. And that I love you. Those are the most powerful words you can say. And they might not always come to you in the beginning. Because your mom, your dad, but as long as they know they do have that platform.
Yeah, and hearing a little bit of what you said, like you, I think you probably did a lot more than you even realize. Just by you and your husband being invested in therapy, you sort of normalize that it's okay to get help. The unfortunate part is, like, you can't protect, like, the people that you love from pain. It's about teaching them how to deal with that pain. And being able to process and like when we see someone hurting, right, we want to take that away as quickly as we can. But sometimes that can be the wrong thing to do, because there's a lot of lesson that comes in pain.
Yeah.
And speaking to your point too, you know, validation goes a long way. And sometimes people think like validating is like agreeing with someone's viewpoint and saying like, okay, this behavior is all right. It's not that. It's just about understanding like why they might be thinking and feeling and behaving the way that they are based on what they've got going on. You know, the teenage brain is a fascinating thing because like it's developing in some really cool ways. And then, you know, they still can have impulsivities that seem totally like logical and justified to them. A lot of us look for only external validation to make us okay. And, you know, I do a meditation group at the homeless shelter that I work at. And at the end of it, I always tell them that you are worthy and that you are loved and you're more than enough, just the way that you are. And the thing about abuse is it really starts to make that inner critic like even louder. And that's a hard thing to weather and deal with and recognize. And it takes a lot of intentional work, a lot, months, sometimes years of paying attention to that spot inside of you. So I'm always just amazed by people showing up in my office or calling me and saying like, hey, I need some help, because that's such a gutsy, courageous thing to do. And I tell my clients like, look, I went to therapy school, right? And even when I go see my therapist, I've had tremendous anxiety about that experience. So it's like such a empowering thing. Like I feel like that space is so sacred, and I feel honored to be a part of it, because it's such a strong, empowered move to make, to say, hey, I don't know what to do with this, but I need a little bit of support.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience. Yes, right here.
As a people pleaser and someone that does look for affirmation from people and also trust, I think the main thing is like I trust people before they give me a reason to trust them. What's the most healthy way to take action and express to a friendship relationship that is toxic or that is not helpful to your life that you do want to cut off?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it does depend on a number of factors. Like if doing so, having that conversation is going to cause you more harm, then just, you know, cut ties and move on. You know, same things. You block them on social media. Also, sometimes when we do struggle with that people-pleasing part, we're spending all this energy because we're trying to tell that other person, like, look, if you just understand, like, I know you won't feel this way, or I know you won't treat me that way, right? And that doesn't work. That's a losing battle. So I think that just being able to recognize when that urge is coming in, like being able to say, like, I'm doing that thing. Like, that's why I tell people to tune in, because you can get a lot of information by just paying attention and doing so in a non-judgmental way to what's going on in here.
One of the things that works for me is, being someone who has been through a lot of, you know, pain and rejection, and I had become numb to it. But then I had to just tell myself, you know what? It stops right here. So I have prayed and asked for the gift of goodbye. And I have it. If people come into my life and I feel that negative energy and that toxicity, and I'm like, no, I don't owe you an explanation for anything. It just stops right here and goodbye, and there's no looking back. But it took a long time for me to get there. And because it took so long, I really guard that and I protect that. Your peace is priceless. So understand that.
Ooh.
Yeah. So good. Yes, question right here.
So I know firsthand in watching families and generations that there can be those positive affirmations around two people, the exact same positive affirmations, and one person can move back to an internal belief about themselves and it can change their life, and one person does not. They continue to believe I'm not worthy. What would you say as like a potential like encourager of someone else? How can we deliver those positive affirmations in a way that will encourage internalization and a belief change at their core?
I have one word for it. It's just don't even let it be your words. Let it be your action. Mm-hmm. Action is everything. Sometimes, you know, people hear affirmations, but it doesn't saturate. So just show it. You know, if you tell someone you love them or that they're worthy, you show them that. You know, you give them that little nugget. Sometimes it's just planting that seed. And then we just have to believe that someone will bring the water and it will blossom. So things have to sometimes, they got to die in the ground before it could have life. So I'm one of those metaphoric type of people. But just keep doing what you're doing. Show the love. Don't let your words be action.
When I'm working with people that are kind of struggling with some of this stuff, sometimes I have them do an exercise where I want them to identify what their values are, like what's important to them. And I think when people do that, it's like the first time they've ever done that. And one of the main reasons I have folks do that is because when you understand like what your core values are, like what's important to you, you can then hold those values up to any relationship, any job, any big decision in your life, and have a lot of clarity on whether or not those relationships or people or that job lines up with those values. And if it doesn't, then it's probably a good time to like trust your gut and be like, this looks really good, but there's all these things that aren't lining up, and maybe go the other way. But I think people have to find that for themselves. Like, you can be that encourager. Sometimes people get energy too from when they're at that space of that poor self-worth, feeding into like, no, you're not that way. You're not that way. Right. And then you get in this role of trying to convince them over and over because they might not even recognize, but they're getting energy from that sort of dance. Like, that negative energy is still attention. Right. And that's a hard thing to say, because I say that, but I don't want it to be like, oh, that's what everybody does all the time. Sometimes that's what goes on.
Like an Al-Anon, Al-Anon is like, for those that don't know, it's like a support group for people who are in relationships with alcoholics and addicts. One thing that they talk about in their support groups a lot is like how you can become addicted to chaos.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And especially if you are sort of grown and created in that chaotic environment, it's really all you know. And so you don't know how to decipher sort of how healthy relationships work. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of figuring it out. And so like sometimes it just takes time, like and experiencing real healthy relationships. Yeah. And that just hasn't happened for those people yet. So they just literally don't know what that looks like. But like you can show them.
Yeah, that's precisely why like it takes most people that are in abusive relationships an average of like 7 to 12 times to leave before they actually do. Mm-hmm. Because that abusive environment becomes your new normal.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's this really cool protective thing in your body called homeostasis. And so your body's going to work really hard to resist change of any kind. Mm-hmm. Right. Even when that change is a good change. So these are things to be aware of, that can become really comfortable, and so those signals, those alarms, are turned off.
Right here.
brain's kind of still processing so much, and kind of two parts of it. Like, so someone who is like so into it in deeply, like a dick.
That's what she said. Continue.
Oh, something was wrong.
Everything was right.
It's messy.
But I believe that people can change. So that's like one half of it. And then the other half is like dealing with someone who is maybe like in like an abuser emotionally, but maybe so not so intensely. Is it possible to like you care about this person? It's like, how do you help walk them through this? Like, and be like, I care about you and I want you to like not do this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you have tools to do that?
Mm-hmm. So the first part of your question, it's really rough and it's really painful and ugly. And the main requirement there is a willingness to want to do the work. If there's no willingness, then nobody's going to force anybody into any kind of change. The second part is like, sometimes the best thing you can do is walk away and remove yourself from something that's toxic, that's harming you. Mm-hmm. Right? Because then you're committed to this certain outcome of that's happening. And this is what happens in abusive relationships. Like they think, okay, if I can just love this person more and enough and better in all of these ways, they're gonna change. They're not gonna change until they want to. And sometimes compassion is metaphorically, you know, giving somebody a right hook. It's like getting the hell out of there. Sometimes that's the most compassionate thing to do, is say enough is enough. I'm not going to allow this. I love you, but you need to get some help for that.
I always think like what you allow, you approve of.
That's it.
So the best way that you can teach someone to stop acting abusive is to say, you don't get more. Bye. Get help, yeah. Greg Lewis.
One of the things
get help.
That I had to do is I had to walk away from everything. I mean, I walked away from my place. I walked away from my car. I literally became homeless in order to get out with my three children because I had no family in this state. All my family was in Indiana. But I said, I would rather sleep under a bridge with my three kids before I put up with this another day. I'm leaving. And I did not look back. Pack my stuff and I just started going. It's not easy because we become accustomed to a certain way of life, and you know, it's hard starting over and being a single mother with three kids and what, you know, it goes on and on and on. But your life has meaning. Mm-hmm. And not everybody makes it out. And I had to tell myself, Chevis, there's two things that's going to happen. Either you're going to leave and you're going to struggle and you're going to rebuild your life, or you're going to get your first set of flowers from your person that's harming you, and it's going to be on top of a casket. Now, you choose what you're going to do. And as hard as it was, sis, I had to do what I had to do. And it can, you can rebuild your life after domestic violence. I am 22 years into the DV movement, living a violent-free life, happy, healthy, and single.
Again, just like a little bit about that validation piece that I was talking to earlier. You know, we as humans, like especially if you're in a relationship, you can be abusive to the person that you love from time to time, say the wrong thing out of anger, okay?
I love how you always say knucklehead. Yeah. Anyone can be a knucklehead.
That's right.
It's like a really nice way of putting it when I talk to Michael.
I always give this example, but if I came home and had a really stressful day at work and I was like a jerk to my wife, right? An example of validation would her saying like, hey, Isaac, I understand you had a stressful, long day, and you can't take it out on me, right? It's like she's validating where I'm coming from and then setting a limit. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to talk to me. You can't be short with me just because you had. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's being, like, if somebody's
trying to work on it. Like, we can't expect they're going to be perfect. So it's giving a little bit of grace for, you know, when I work with married couples, you know, it's really teaching them some of that and how to, like, emotionally regulate before they try to have, like, tough conversations. So you can validate those things, but set your limit also. Mm-hmm. I get where you're coming from, and it's still not okay. Like, I get that you grew up in a really abusive home, and you can't be abusive to me, mm-hmm. right?
Boundaries.
Yeah. That's something that I've actually been talking to my therapist a lot about as I've been learning about abuse and emotional abuse and had my own experiences with emotional abuse and grew up in an emotionally abusive home, which was a huge light bulb for me. I didn't even know. It's like I have all of this information, and now there are times when I almost am like, oh God, am I being abusive? Oh God, is my friend being abusive? Oh God, is my husband being abusive? Oh God, we're all abusive. But yeah, it's like you are a knucklehead. You have a long day. You lash out. But that's when I'm like, I come to my therapist. I'm like, am I being abusive? And she's like, no. Let's talk about what actual abuse is. Mm-hmm. And she reminds me what mm-hmm. that is, and reminds me, no, you're okay. You're working through your stuff. You're safe. You're in a good relationship. And that is so helpful for me when I'm like working through and learning about all of this stuff. Is like having someone there mm-hmm. to be like, talk to me. Am I crazy? Am I abusive? And, you know, having someone that knows what I'm talking about. So yep. I think that we have time for one more question, if there's anything. Yes, right here.
Okay.
Maybe
a touchy subject, but spiritual abuse.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
We talked about it relates to all these other abuses. And I grew up in boarding school overseas. That, you know, God says that your kids in boarding school, so we can do mission work. Which led to all kinds of abuse, sexual abuse, which is so common. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious, the healing process through that, and I know it touches on Sarah's story, and also, like, do you see that a lot in, like, your clinics and victims, and, you know, we know that cultic fundamental mm-hmm. set of spiritual abuse leads into that, so.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Yeah, well, we definitely do see the spiritual abuse. It's how it's intertwined with the other dynamics of abuse. And maybe Isaac can speak to this more, but I know that it does show up in a lot of ways for our survivors, to where they're being manipulated and controlled by the Bible and different, you know, ritual types of things. And we do connect them with therapy. And it's kind of like peeling back the layer of an onion. You know, there's so much that's there, and we just have to be mindful and delicate and understanding that trauma of just peeling it back. And I'm going to let you take that one.
I so appreciate you bringing that up, because I don't think that it's something that people talk about too often. I have a whole section on my website devoted to spiritual abuse, because you know, people use religion as a tool, yes. as a weapon, mm-hmm. Sometimes mm-hmm. to do some really horrible things. When you study some of that, it's like always usually the antithesis of what the message of that religion is trying to say, so it's like mind-boggling in a lot of ways. But it can really cloud a lot of things, right? It can, if you had like this vibrant spiritual life, now like that's in question. And then when that's in question, like, you know, you feel like a part of yourself is missing, because maybe something that could have brought you joy and meaning in your life has now been colored in like this really awful way. So the work starts with trying again. Like, I always start with people tuning into their own self. Like, I can't fix anybody. I can help them figure out and see patterns and support them in that, but they're going to have to do that hard work. And I will sit with them and be with them in that, but there will be a lot of that on your own that you have to kind of go into those spots that are really painful, that maybe you've kept the lid on for years and years. And to do that, like, in a way that's very honoring of where you're at too, not trying to rip the Band-Aid off. Like, we want a lot of quick fixes in this culture, right? And you cannot quick fix when you've suffered abuse of any kind. It'll show up in other relationships if you don't take a look at it now.
Thank you, guys. I know we would love to talk to them all night, but we only have the space until 10. So let's give Shavis and Isaac a hand. And let's keep having these conversations.
let's keep normalizing these conversations. Let's keep looking at each other in the eye. It's so important. We can connect online, but it's so important to connect flesh to flesh, face to face, and talk about this stuff. It's so important. So, Tiffany, I will give you the last word.
I just want to say thank you so much for coming. And when we talked about doing this months ago, we were kind of like, I hope someone comes. So the fact that you all came is like so awesome. And just thank you to everybody that was part of the event tonight. And I just really appreciate everyone's vulnerability and honesty. And it's just really fucking cool that you guys came. Really, really cool. Yeah, and we'll be here in like space till like 9:30, yeah, like hanging out. And then we have to like, I guess, clean or something.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for coming to Central.